right. This morning we have one case on our 9 o'clock docket. After that case concludes, we will take a short recess, and then we will return for one case on our 10:30 docket. The first case is Prieto versus Bell Aerospace Services. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties.
May it please the court, Mr. Hal Gillespie to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Steve Taylor to argue for the appellant.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Gillespie.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
Nice to see judges smile at me, at least at the start of a presentation. This is a very important case, and it involves a good law in Texas. In Texas, people who work for a company, need their jobs, don't have to go along to get along. They actually refuse to commit a criminal act, and if they get fired for doing that, for the sole reason that that's why they got fired, then they're protected under state law. So we have a man here named Mike Prieto, who was the head of a business unit of Bell Helicopter Textron. And he was the charged with the obligation of finding out if there was any mischarging or procurement fraud going on. That was one of his obligations under the Textron policies. He was charged with finding out what was going on and stopping it if it were to occur. And sadly enough, he found out that there was both procurement fraud and mischarging going on, and he did something about it and was literally ordered to stop, to cease immediately. His trial, we survived two motions for summary judgment, and then we tried the case, and we spent 4 weeks trying this case. And during the trial, the evidence got better. During the trial, we actually had Mr. Prieto's immediate superior, Mr. Blake, testify that what he meant by Plaintiff's Exhibit 80, where he had, it certainly looked like he was telling Prieto to be quiet. He said that that's in fact what he meant. Yes, he meant to cease his investigation and stop putting out information about it. So that's the nature of the case, and Mr. Prieto was fired. He was doing a great job, was told on April 22, 2008, you're a high potential a performer. You're doing a good job. You're being considered for promotion. And on June 5th, he was fired. Now, what happened in between April to 22nd and June 5th is that he found out about procurement fraud, and then he found out about mischarging the government. And I would like, Your Honors, to take a look at something the government never got to see, something that Mr. Prieto would have brought forward to the government if he had had a chance to. And that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 106A. That's at tab 8 in our appendix. And there, time doesn't permit me to read all of it, but
was that admitted at trial?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. Okay. Look at TR within Plaintiff's Exhibit 106A at tab 8. Look at TR 21, which is a statement of Debbie Elwood, TR 26, that's transcript page, Steve Waters' statement, TR 38, Simon Gray's statement. These statements are horrific. They say that for the last 6 years there's been mischarging. They say that they've been keeping track of it and that their employer, their boss gets mad at them when they raise the issue. Ms. Elwood said she had a spreadsheet and that she kept track of it, and her boss got mad at her when he found out about that. Mr. Prieto, on the job, had directed an investigation, even though he was told not to. He refused that order, and knowing that he was making a terrible choice between doing the right thing as a citizen and putting his job at risk.
But let me clarify something. You're talking about two types of alleged criminal conduct, or at least misconduct, procurement fraud and mischarging.
Yes.
Wasn't Mr. Prieto told not to pursue at least the mischarging claims because those were being handled by other offices within the corporation?
He was told not to pursue either one.
Okay.
And he was, Ms. Tate specifically testified that she said the same thing to him on the government, mischarging the government, as on mischarging. And Mr. Prieto, whose testimony has to be believed for purposes of a directed verdict, testified that that's what he was told, that he was specifically called and told the same thing with reference to mischarging the government by Tate, that she had said to him in an email. She has that cease immediately email. That's Plaintiff's Exhibit 80. So we know that all that happened.
Gillespie?
Yes, sir.
If Mr. Prieto had information that he thought was criminal, and he was told not to tell the government about that, and he didn't tell the government about that, where does that put him?
Oh, he actually did go to the government. So I don't think that that's an issue we have to deal with on Sabine Pilots, but the fact is he did go to the government. He was briefed by the government. He gave all the information to them that he's presented at trial. So he's a good citizen. He has done that. What he was going to do, and he put this in Plaintiff's Exhibit 84, he said to his boss on May the 30th, and that's effectively the last business day before he was fired, that he was going to complete the investigation. He described how it was going. He said that he had another 30 interviews to go, and then he was going to quantify how much money had been stolen from the government. And Mr. Millman, and this is a testimony, Mr. Millman, after he got that email, he was happy with Ms. Tate's response to it, which said don't go to the government and talk about certain things. But after May 30, he called a meeting and directed Mr. Prieto to be fired. What's interesting about that is that another guy was fired, Mr. Bolton, and Mr. Bolton was their excuse at the time that they terminated Mr. Prieto for firing Mr. Prieto. Well, Mr. Bolton had already been fired. The decision had already been made to fire Mr. Bolton before Mr. Prieto was fired. And when Mr. Millman testified, he said that he didn't make the decision to fire Mr. Prieto, that was way below his pay grade. But he did make the decision to fire Mr. Prieto. A jury can infer from that that the reason that Mr. Prieto got fired was that Mr. Millman didn't want any more of this investigation, didn't want anyone like Mr. Prieto who would quantify and not water down. I would like for you to look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 120, if you would. Plaintiff's Exhibit 120 is a devastating document in terms of our evidence because it shows that the when a report was made, it was not made to include all the Plaintiff's Exhibit 106A. That was not contained. There was no reference that there had been mischarging for 6 years, that one of the people had literally caught 300 hours of mischarging himself, and that's in one of those statements that I've pointed you to. Plaintiff's Exhibit 120 whitewashes it by saying there could have been mischarging, and by saying the amount of mischarging we've determined was negligible, 54.3 hours. And that's not consistent with Plaintiff's Exhibit 106A. What we know from our evidence showed that those Baker interviews, which Mr. Prieto had directed, he would look at them every day when Ms. Baker was doing those interviews, and they were good interviews, but they got deep sixed. They never went to anyone. They didn't even go to Ms. Tate. They did not go to the government. They were kept quiet. Now, I've got to talk to... I think the most important piece, single piece of evidence that there was criminal activity for which he was fired was the testimony of Mr. Clegg, who literally admitted that he could infer. Now, he's at Textron, and Mr. Prieto was bringing him into the loop and asking for help, begging for help, seeking an answer. He was promised a quick answer, and he got one. He got fired. But Mr. Clegg admitted that he could infer from Prieto's emails that Prieto was fired for refusing to commit criminal acts. Now, that's powerful evidence that a jury could also make that inference because those emails were in evidence. We need to talk about the fact that this judge did not allow us to call a criminal law expert. We preserved that error. There was a ruling made on that on March 31, 2011. And the ruling, which is at Court Record 97, says that the motion was made to strike Tom Mills as an expert. That was defendant's motion. And the judge considered the motion, plaintiff's response, and the arguments of counsel, and granted the motion. Now, that shows that we opposed it and that the motion was granted. And we didn't need to, we certainly didn't call Mr. Mills is a witness. We didn't put him on his witness list after we had that order. We were not going to defy the court's order. But it made a big difference that weren't able to call an expert. Now, we've briefed it, but one of the basis for the court overturning a decision on an expert is abuse of discretion. And but what you look at is several factors, whether it was arbitrary or unreasonable. I submit to you that it's unreasonable. What the court had, the trial court had to be saying, was that when these jurors, what a criminal law expert would know, Tom Mills was a criminal law expert, was within the common knowledge of someone on a jury. When someone is being accused, is being put in a position where they may be committing white collar crime, and the government has a batch of laws against such criminal activity, including aid and abetting and conspiracy, which we think we were entitled to instructions on because the evidence supported those charges, then a lawyer comes in handy. The judge was putting these people, assuming that everyone should be their own lawyer. Well, in terms of white-collar crime and where you can go to jail, you're not required to face that gauntlet. This court wrote a meaningful, important decision on Sabine pilots in the Morales versus Simulflight Training International case in 2004. And I know that Your Honor, Chief Judge Livingston was on that panel. That case dealt with alleged fraud and aiding and abetting. And the court wrote, under the federal law, Morales could have been charged at the very least with aiding and abetting the falsification of the FRF, regardless of whether he knew what Simulflight would write in it or whether he knew that FRF would be presented to the FAA. The court said, Simulflight asserts Morales could not be charged under the federal statute for falsifying because it's only an internal document. And the court went on to say the fact that Simulflight only used the document internally did not relieve Morales of any possibility of being charged under the statute. What the trial court did by denying us our instructions and by denying us the right to call an expert, and we had a very qualified expert who was basing his opinion upon the kinds of things that he could reasonably base his opinion upon. What he did was he set the jury adrift to figure out complex statutes, white-collar statutes. It's not like burglary. It's not like murder. It's something where people should not be required to hope and pray that when they don't do what their gut tells them they should do, they won't be prosecuted. Maybe he wouldn't have been prosecuted. One of the things we know in the Sabine pilots case is, by definition, no one got prosecuted. There's a great new opinion from the Texas Supreme Court, the Safe Shred case, and that certainly helps us on the malice claim, and we think that jury question should have gone to the jury. The Safe Shred case says when you have a Sabine pilots case, you didn't do the criminal act that you were accused, that you were ordered to do. Maybe if you did it and got in trouble, you would have a claim, some other claim. they actually say that. But they say that for purposes of malice, if you show that the people who did what they did it knowing that they were breaking the law, then that's evidence of malice, and we have that kind of evidence in this case. We have regulations that say there won't be retaliation. We have everyone in line there admitting that there was no investigation to see whether or not there was retaliation going on against Mike Prieto, and it looked like that's where he was headed.
Mr. Gillespie, about out of your time, and I want to ask you another question, please, sir. You're contending that your client was told not to discuss things that would have caused him to have been refusing to admit to or to testify about a commission of a crime at the helicopter place. Anything in writing other than the letter that or the email from Lee Tate dated Friday, May 30th, 2:08, 8:51 a.m., anything in writing other than that telling him what to do about talking with the government?
Well, there was. Plaintiff's Exhibit 84 also says don't brief the DCAA on the fact that Bolton compromised your investigation. Now,
well, that's what both of them said then.
No, the other one was Plaintiff's Exhibit 80. And Plaintiff's Exhibit 80 is the one that says cease immediately.
And all right. Well, I'm looking at this this email from Ms. Tate, and it doesn't tell him not to talk to DCMA. It merely suggests to me, as I read it, that he should confine himself to the facts and the actions taken to date.
That's one email, Your Honor, and the other one, there is another one. That's Plaintiff's Exhibit 80. You're looking at Plaintiff's Exhibit 84. And then on top of that, we have the testimony. Tate admitted that she told him, cease, don't do the investigation on procurement fraud or on labor mischarging. And Mr. Prieto, whose testimony has to be believed for purposes of directed verdict, testified that Tate literally told him both those things. And it's a rabbit trail to get off on the fact that he didn't actually get the email from Tate until after he had briefed the DCAA. The message in that brief or in that email was, keep it quiet, don't raise it. And he was on the verge of doing a full briefing of the government, and he was fired before he could do it. I see my time's up, and I'll have a little bit for rebuttal.
Before you leave, tell me, where is the plaintiff's exhibit 80 and what you've given us here? There's a whole big bunch of stuff, maybe 30, I don't know how many pages there are behind one exhibit, with no numbers telling us where to look.
Your Honor, I know that's a court exhibit, and I know it's MP.
Did you attach it to your brief is what I'm asking.
I don't believe we did attach it to our brief.
I don't think you did either,
but
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Mr. Tatum.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the Bell parties in this appeal, and amid all the contentions and all of the arguments you've heard so far, much of which isn't supported by the record, I think all the court needs to do really is focus on the nature of the claim that was taken to the jury and which the court granted a directed verdict on, and that is the Sabine pilot claim. It's a very simple three-step process that puts a very, very, very strict burden of proof on the plaintiff. You have to prove, and there is no, unlike other labor and employment matters, there is no burden shifting back and forth from one side to the other in this type of case. The burden always remains with the plaintiff, and that burden is he was ordered to commit an illegal act. The plaintiff refused to perform the illegal act, and as a sole cause, because of that sole cause and no other reason, the plaintiff was terminated. Bell's brief fully sets out the reasons why that burden wasn't met and why the directed verdict was proper. But the court doesn't really need to go over anything other than the sole cause issue if the court wishes to just to focus on one element that will dispose of this matter. The Sabine pilot case requires that the plaintiff, that the refusal to commit an alleged illegal act, and we're not accepting the argument that there was an illegal act that ever took place. There has been no proof of any, or there was a requirement that an illegal act take place. We're not admitting to any of that. I'm just, for the purposes of argument, focusing on what I think is the easiest way to dispose of the case, and that is the sole cause requirement. The record contains evidence from Mr. Millman, who was Mr. Prieto's ultimate supervisor, regarding his performance of his duties as the chief executive officer of Bell Aero. And there are, it's a list of many things, poor performance, there were missed financial goals, there were numerous corrective actions taken from the federal government, among those that we're talking about today. There were interpersonal problems that Mr. Prieto had with his general manager. He was directed to solve those problems or to deal with them or try to deal with them, and he refused. Mr. Millman, the Bell Helicopter Textron CEO, lost confidence in his ability to lead the division after several years of missed goals, performance problems with the manufacturing of the helicopters that unit made. He became frustrated with poor leadership. The operating plans were not being met. There were inaccurate business forecasts by Mr. Preto. In other words, there's a whole list of things that went undisputed in the record regarding Mr. Millman's motive for terminating Mr. Preto's employment. That by itself, unrebutted testimony, is enough to defeat and to authorize the trial court to grant the directed verdict that it granted finally, because that evidence, unrebutted, makes it impossible to recover under the Sabine Pilot theories that were advanced to the court. There was no evidence of an illegal act. That's another one of the issues. What you've heard is references to certain emails. There is one, really, that's important, and it is the one where Mr. Preto was instructed, speak with the government, tell the government about where our investigation is, but this new matter that just came up, Mr. Bolton's email, let us look into that before we talk to the government about it. And in fact, he received that email after he'd already spoken to the government. The record reflects that he'd received that email after he'd spoken with the government. So even if that email contained some sort of nefarious direction to do something, it arrived a day or two late. But the fact of the matter is there was nothing inappropriate about the email.
I was going to ask, is this the May 30th email from Tate?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Preto actually admitted that he didn't receive that email until after he'd already spoken with the government. And he also admitted that he did not discuss Mr. Bolton's email, which was a new issue that apparently had come up or come to his attention or their attention during his conversation with the government. There is no evidence of an illegal act. There was no evidence that there was any obligation on the part of Mr. Preto to do something, the failure of which would expose him to criminal prosecution. There's no statutory basis for his claim that he was under an obligation to report the labor mischarging investigation, which in fact the government already knew about. The government knew about that before any of this came up. Bell was conducting the investigation, and in fact, I think the evidence is clear that Bell's internal investigation process had been initiated by Mr. Preto. He's the one who referred this matter to Tate in the beginning. And I think it's if nothing else, it's good corporate policy to only have one investigation going on if there's some problem. You don't want to have conflicting investigations. But that's an inference that has nothing to do with the evidence other than the fact that Mr. Preto had, in fact, referred all of this upstairs to the appropriate office before any of this began. The court correctly noted that Mr. Preto did, in fact, comply, even though he received the email late. He did comply with its direction and only discussed those matters that he was familiar with in terms of the progress of the investigation at the time that he spoke with the government. The issue about the expert witness, I think, is very simply disposed of. In order to preserve error for an excluded witness, there has to be some sort of offer of proof. And I don't think the court will find one in the record. That, I think, if there was any error in excluding that expert, I think that takes care of that problem. The references to the interference, supposed interference or alleged interference by Bell Textron with Mr. Preto's investigation is simply incorrect. I think the evidence is undisputed that Mr. Preto initially referred this to Bell Helicopter Textron. The speculation about Mr. Millman's motives that the court's heard and it's been in the briefing is simply that. Mr. Millman's testimony was undisputed. There were no witnesses that said, oh, no, he didn't say this, he said this. Oh, no, he didn't write this, there's another memo that says this. His testimony regarding his thoughts about Mr. Prieto's performance of his duties was undisputed. Whether Mr. Prieto disagrees with his conclusions is speculation. It's not evidence. The fact is that Mr. Millman had more than sufficient cause to terminate Mr. Prieto regardless of this investigation. And I think that by itself solves or answers the Sabine Pilot question. To correct, I think, something that may have been a misstatement by counsel, Mr. Clegg never testified that Mr. Prieto was told to break the law. What he testified about is that he could tell that Mr. Prieto thought that. He himself didn't agree. And the members of the team that investigated the labor overcharging ultimately found some overcharging. The government, it was reported to the government, it was disposed of, that matter was resolved, and none of them believed that there was any compromise of that investigation that investigation resulted in anything other than what the truth required it to result in.
And was there any evidence of this procurement fraud investigation going on? Was that a separate track?
It's a separate track and really doesn't involve potential criminal liability. It's kind of a rabbit trail. Procurement fraud, if to the extent it existed, and there may have been some activities that might have been discovered. I'm not really terribly familiar with that, other than to say that was involved a contract with the government of the country of Colombia. The United States government, the United States Justice Department had nothing to do with that. And thus, not that there were any criminal activities undertaken or that there was any criminal activity required of Mr. Prieto involved in that investigation. That investigation would not have resulted in any criminal liability in any event because the federal government wasn't involved. It was a private contract with a foreign government. So, to be honest with you, I think that particular issue is probably irrelevant to the Sabine Pilot question altogether. In short, there were a lot of things thrown around in the courtroom, but when the court looks at the actual testimony, when the court looks at the actual evidence that was presented to the jury, directed verdict was appropriate. There simply was no evidence sufficient to get to the jury on the Sabine Pilot claim, which was the sole claim in this lawsuit.
Have you ever seen a case in which a directed verdict was granted after a mistrial?
I have not, but we have provided the court with authority for the fact that the court does have that authority if it's undertaken within the court's plenary power. And this was, in fact, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks after the mistrial was declared, the judge went on vacation, and when he came back, all of this had happened. But I think that I think the law is fairly clear that, and it's in the briefing that the court had the authority to do that because it took place before his plenary power had expired.
Mr. Tatum, I'm just curious, and I read all these briefs, and I looked at. Oh, not all, but a good many of these exhibits. And whatever happened to Mr. Wilson? Do you know the man I'm talking about who was with the company when it was acquired by Bell? That was a small Alabama company.
I know exactly who you're speaking about, and I don't know, Your Honor. I didn't see it in here,
and I was just curious if he remained with the company after these other two people were fired.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just so the court's clear about the sequence, I wanted to make sure the question was answered correctly. The mistrial was set aside in the directed verdict hearing. The trial court heard the directed verdict motion in sort of two parts. If the record reflects that the court heard the motion for a directed verdict, went out of town, without ruling on the motion for directed verdict. A judge came, sat, and presided over the jury deliberations while that motion was still pending. When the court returned, there was a hearing in which the motion for directed verdict was responded to, and the court then ruled after that. So there actually wasn't, but to get there, the court did reverse the mistrial that had been granted by the temporary sitting judge. That's specifically the sequence of events. If the court has no other questions, I will give a few minutes back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tatum. Mr. Gillespie, rebuttal.
Thank you. Justice Myers, I have an answer to your question on where that other email is. There's Defendant's Exhibit 30, which is tab 9 to their appendix. And there it is. Tab 9 to Bell's appendix has got that email, and it's dated May 12, 2008, so just right after he had been told he was doing a great job. And this one is from Tate to Prieto, and it says, by coming to me and Ken Reeves, you have put the matter in our hands. It is inappropriate and unnecessary for you to be conducting any ancillary investigation, and if you are doing so, I must ask you to immediately cease. And she testified that she gave the same order for mischarging to him, and he testified to that too. Now, the counsel, Mr. Tatum, didn't try this case, and I can tell you that at the trial, every reason they trotted out for having terminated Mr. Prieto, we rebutted. And we have this addressed in our brief. They went through a whole series of reasons why they fired him. They also went through a lie about who fired him to begin with. They said Mike Blake made the decision to fire him. I took his deposition. He said, no, I didn't. And ultimately, a long time later, Mr. Millman said he did. We had all kinds of evidence of pretext, and we think that's a reason why the pretext instruction should be granted. And there's great law on that. Supreme Court of the United States in Reeves says that that's the way you prove circumstantial evidence. Where the other side doesn't admit it, you have to prove it, and that's a proof mechanism available. The Fifth Circuit, which is what the courts in Texas sometimes look at, in the Ratcliffe case said you do that. You do have to give that instruction because that's now the law. The jury can't guess that that's the law. They wouldn't know, and that's an important piece of law.
Were the cases that you mentioned Sabine Pilot cases?
No, they weren't. No, and so we're asking you to make law on that. The pattern jury instruction came along after that law. Sabine Pilots precedes the Reeves case. So we're asking you to do what logically you would do. I can't simply argue to the jury that that's the law. That's the judge gives the law to the jury, and the judge didn't give an equivalent instruction. You can look at that jury charge, and it's not there. Counsel was incorrect in saying that we had waived the expert issue. The Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure 33.1A1 says that as long as the complaint is made before the trial, then it's been preserved. And it goes on in subsection C to say that there's no formal exception or separate order required. Again, we didn't ambush them by this. We tried to get Mr. Mills, and we wanted to have Mr. Mills, and the judge ruled that we couldn't. It is not a side issue. Procurement's not a side issue. Counsel is spinning the facts, which I don't blame him for, favorably to the defendant, but our evidence was that procurement is criminal. Blake testified that it was, specifically with reference to this procurement investigation, and in fact our evidence was that they've been building seats this way in Alabama, and that's where Mr. Wilson is now, Your Honor. He's still in Alabama. Willie Wilson, he's there. He got fired, but he's still there building helicopters.
He's not working for Bell or
correct.
Any of their associates.
That's right. But they were building helicopters seats the same way before this Colombian transaction. That's our evidence, and the evidence is that they were doing it wrong. They were violating government procurement laws, and so you can't infer that this was the first time they'd ever done it. And Ms. Tate, in fact, testified that this wasn't the first time they'd ever done it. It was the same process. So those issues are before the court. We had evidence from which the jury could conclude that Mike Tate did the right thing, that he would have faced or could have faced criminal prosecution if he had gone along with what in fact was a cover-up. There could have been $7 to $90 million worth of government money taken by Bell. And instead of that, they issued a report, Plaintiff's Exhibit 120, that says it's about $4,000 that they managed to, it's minimal. And that wasn't the case. That's not the report that Mr. Prieto would have given. And tellingly, once he was terminated, he was the head of that investigation. They cut off the head. They didn't replace him. They didn't go to him to see where are you going on this. When they fired him, they didn't ask him. They didn't tell him how the investigation was going, and they didn't ask him any questions about the investigation. And they lied to him. They said the reason for the termination was because you don't get along with a subordinate, someone who they had already fired. That's all the time I've got. This is a really important case, Your Honor. Prieto, we think, is an American hero. He's not like the folks that who did the wrong thing, I think, up at Penn State. This is a guy who I'm proud to represent. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gillespie, Mr. Tatum, and all other counsel. We appreciate all your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and you all are excused. We will take a recess and then pick up with our 10:30 case, Waterway versus Annetta.